Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We go now live to the White House, where President Obama is announcing his nomination for the latest Supreme Court opening.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody, please have a seat. Good morning, everybody. Of the many responsibilities accorded to a president by our Constitution, few are more weighty or consequential than that of appointing a Supreme Court justice, particularly one to succeed a giant in the law like Justice John Paul Stevens. For nearly 35 years, Justice Stevens has stood as an impartial guardian of the law, faithfully applying the core values of our founding to the cases and controversies of our time. He's done so with restraint and respect for precedent, understanding that a judge's job is to interpret, not make law, but also with fidelity to the constitutional ideal of equal justice for all. He's brought to each case not just mastery of the letter of the law, but a keen understanding of its impact on people's lives. And he has emerged as a consistent voice of reason, helping his colleagues find common ground on some of the most controversial and contentious issues the court has ever faced. While we can't presume to replace Justice Stevens's wisdom or experience, I have selected a nominee who I believe embodies that same excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law, and who can ultimately provide that same kind of leadership on the court. Our Solicitor General and my friend, Elena Kagan. Yeah. Good. Elena is widely regarded as one of the nation's foremost legal minds. She's an acclaimed legal scholar with a rich understanding of constitutional law. She's a former White House aide with a lifelong commitment to public service and a firm grasp of the nexus and boundaries between our three branches of government. She's a trailblazing leader, the first woman to serve as dean of Harvard Law School, and one of the most successful and beloved deans in its history. And she is a superb Solicitor General, our nation's chief lawyer, representing the American people's interests before the Supreme Court. The first woman in that position as well. And she has won accolades from observers across the ideological spectrum for her well-reasoned arguments and commanding presence. But Elena is respected and admired not just for her intellect and record of achievement, but also for her temperament, her openness to a broad array of viewpoints, her habit, to borrow a phrase from Justice Stevens, of understanding before disagreeing, her fair-mindedness and skill as a consensus builder. These traits were particularly evident during her tenure as dean, at a time when many believed that Harvard faculty had gotten a little one-sided in its viewpoint. She sought to recruit prominent conservative scholars and spur a healthy debate on campus. And she encouraged students from all backgrounds to respectfully exchange ideas and seek common ground. Because she believes, as I do, that exposure to a broad array of perspectives is the foundation not just for a sound legal education, but of a successful life in the law. And this appreciation for diverse views may also come in handy as a diehard Mets fan, serving alongside her new colleague, Yankees fan Justice Sotomayor, who I believe has ordered a pinstripe robe for the occasion. But while Elena had a brilliant career in academia, her passion for the law is anything but academic. She's often referred to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, for whom she clerked, as her hero. I understand that he reciprocated by calling her Shorty. Nonetheless, she credits him with reminding her that, as she put it, behind law there are stories. Stories of people's lives as shaped by the law, stories of people's lives as might be changed by the law. That understanding of law, not as an intellectual exercise or words on a page, but as it affects the lives of ordinary people, has animated every step of Elena's career, including her service as Solicitor General today. During her time in this office, she's repeatedly defended the rights of shareholders and ordinary citizens against unscrupulous corporations. Last year, in the Citizens United case, she defended bipartisan campaign finance reform against special interests seeking to spend unlimited money to influence our elections. Despite long odds of success, with most legal analysts believing the government was unlikely to prevail in this case, Elena still chose it as her very first case to argue before the court. I think that says a great deal, not just about Elena's tenacity, but about her commitment to serving the American people. I think it says a great deal about her commitment to protect our fundamental rights, because in a democracy, powerful interests must not be allowed to drown out the voices of ordinary citizens. And I think it says a great deal about the path that Elena has chosen. Someone as gifted as Elena could easily have settled into a comfortable life in a corporate law practice. Instead, she chose a life of service. Service to her students, service to her country, service to the law, and to all those whose lives it shapes. And given Elena's upbringing, it's a choice that probably came naturally. Elena's the granddaughter of immigrants whose mother was for 20 years a beloved public school teacher, as are her two brothers who are here today. Her father was a housing lawyer devoted to the rights of tenants. Both were the first in their families to attend college. And from an early age, they instilled in Elena not just the value of a good education, but the importance of using it to serve others. As she recalled during her Solicitor General confirmation hearings, both my parents wanted me to succeed in my chosen profession. But more than that, both drilled into me the importance of service, character, and integrity. Elena's also spoken movingly about how her mother had grown up at a time when women had few opportunities to pursue their ambitions and took great joy in watching her daughter do so. Neither she nor Elena's father lived to see this day, but I think her mother would relish this moment. I think she would relish, as I do, the prospect of three women taking their seat on the nation's highest court for the first time in history. A court that would be more inclusive, more representative, more reflective of us as people than ever before. And I think they would be tremendously proud of their daughter, a great lawyer, a great teacher, and a devoted public servant who I am confident will make an outstanding Supreme Court justice. So I hope that the Senate will act in a bipartisan fashion, as they did in confirming Elena to be our Solicitor General last year, and that they will do so as swiftly as possible so she can get busy and take her seat in time to fully participate in the work of the court this fall. With that, I would like to invite the person who I believe will be the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States, Elena Kagan, to say a few words.
Thank you, Mr. President. I am honored and I am humbled by this nomination and by the confidence you have shown in me. During the last year, as I have served as Solicitor General, my longstanding appreciation for the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional democracy has become ever deeper and richer. The Court is an extraordinary institution. In the work it does and in the work it can do for the American people by advancing the tenets of our Constitution, by upholding the rule of law, and by enabling all Americans, regardless of their background or their beliefs, to get a fair hearing and an equal chance at justice. And within that extraordinary institution, Justice Stevens has played a particularly distinguished and exemplary role. It is therefore a special honor to be nominated to fill his seat. I have felt blessed to represent the United States before the Supreme Court, to walk into the highest court in this country when it is deciding its most important cases, cases that have an impact on so many people's lives. And to represent the United States there is the most thrilling and the most humbling task a lawyer can perform. I've been fortunate to have been supported in all the work I've done as Solicitor General by a remarkable group of lawyers and staff, many of whom are here today. They exemplify professionalism, public service, and integrity, and I am grateful for all that they have taught me. My professional life has been marked by great good fortune. I clerked for a judge, Abner Mikva, who represents the best in public service, and for a justice, Thurgood Marshall, who did more to promote justice over the course of his legal career than did any lawyer in his lifetime. I have had the opportunity to serve under two remarkable presidents who have devoted themselves to lifting the lives of others and who have inspired a great many more to do the same. I had the privilege of leading one of the world's great law schools and of working there to bring people together and to help ensure that they and the school were making the largest possible contribution to the public good, both in this country and around the world. I am proud of what all of us accomplished there. And through most of my professional life, I've had the simple joy of teaching, of trying to communicate to students why I so love the law, not just because it's challenging and endlessly interesting, although it certainly is that, but because law matters, because it keeps us safe, because it protects our most fundamental rights and freedoms, and because it is the foundation of our democracy. I am thankful to my brothers and other family and friends for coming to Washington to be with me here today. And much more, I am thankful for all of their support and loyalty and love, not just on this day, but always. If this day has just a touch of sadness in it for me, it is because my parents aren't here to share it. They were both, as the president said, the children of immigrants and the first in their families to go to college. My father was the kind of lawyer who used his skills and training to represent everyday people and to improve a community. My mother was a proud public school teacher, as are my two brothers, the kind of teachers whom students remember for the rest of their lives. My parents' lives and their memory remind me every day of the impact public service can have. And I pray every day that I live up to the example they set. Mr. President, I look forward to working with the Senate in the next stage of this process, and I thank you again, Mr. President, for this honor of a lifetime. Thank you so much.
President Obama, live coverage of the president nominating his Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, to the United States Supreme Court. The applause in the room continues. Elena Kagan flanked by the president and Vice President Biden. The president referenced most notably, perhaps, her tenure as the first woman dean of the Harvard Law School, where she reached out to appoint more conservatives to the faculty, upon deciding that they were underrepresented. In a minute, we'll get reaction from Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, and we'll get analysis from Dahlia. And listeners, we want your reaction. Elena Kagan is a New Yorker. Anybody know her? Anybody know her family? She has at least one relative who teaches where she went to school, Hunter College Elementary and High School. Reactions to the Elena Kagan nomination, and we'll get much more into it in a minute. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as you may have just heard, President Obama has just nominated his Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, to the U.S. Supreme Court. She would become the third woman and the third Jewish member of the current court, if confirmed, and the second of two Obama nominees to come from New York. Elena Kagan is 50 years old, from the Upper West Side, a graduate of Hunter College Elementary and High School. She's never been a judge, but does argue before the Supreme Court as Solicitor General. And she is said to get along well with Antonin Scalia and other conservative members of the court, despite not sharing their ideology for the most part. Reportedly, the president is interested in these relationships and Kagan's history as a consensus builder as dean of the once fractious Harvard Law School, hoping Kagan can influence the crucial swing voter on the court, Justice Anthony Kennedy. The president did refer in his remarks there to her temperament and her outreach to conservatives as dean at Harvard Law. Listeners, our phones are open for your reactions to the nomination of Elena Kagan to the U.S. Supreme Court. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for our comments page on this. Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the court for Slate, is with us. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Brian.
And let's jump right into your take on the motivation for this nomination, which is that influencing Justice Kennedy is no reason to pick a Supreme Court justice. Why not?
Well, you know, I think it's just a very complicated game. I think that trying to tease out who could possibly influence a 74-year-old man who's incredibly complicated just strikes me as a sort of psych 101 experiment and not a jurisprudential vision. Now, that said, I think that Kagan has these amazing skills that Obama just talked about, this ability to reframe issues so that conservatives and liberals can come together, this ability to build consensus, a profound respect for the right, that, you know, as you said, was exemplified by her hiring strategy at Harvard. So I want to disaggregate the fact that I think she is Obama-like in her ability to reach across the aisle. I think that's important. I think when that question becomes so granular as to whether she or the other shortlisters are going to flip Kennedy, I think that's when it begins to be silly.
All right. Before we get into any more analysis, let's do a little bit of personal connection here. We're getting a few people who know Elena Kagan calling in. And you know what? My mouse isn't working on my computer. So, Debbie, could you put up line one, Allison on the Upper West Side? Allison, you know Elena Kagan?
Well, I haven't seen her for many years, but we went to elementary and high school together. She and my sister were in the same class. And she was a force of nature back then, just incredibly, incredibly smart. My sister and I talked about it this morning when we heard the news that she would likely be nominated. And, the people we connected her most with in high school were like our famed social studies teacher, Ira Marion Hoff, and stuff, rather than, you know, us. And we just find it surreal that we know her. You know, we haven't seen her in a long time, but
Allison,
oh my God.
What'd you mean by force of nature? As a little kid, she was an intellectual force of nature?
Yes, she was. And, you know, her mother, who she spoke about just now, taught in our elementary school. And her mom was a force of nature, too. She was a tough cookie, demanding, but someone you could go to. And I didn't feel like I could go to too many adults when I was a child, but I knew I could go to Gloria Kagan. She was a tremendous teacher. She really was.
All right, Allison, thank you very much. In fact, let's put on together here. Debbie, can you do this for me? Barbara in Jersey City on line 2 and Janice in Riverdale on line 7. Barbara, you went to high school with Elena
yes.
Kagan. And Janice, you taught Elena Kagan in high school?
I did.
Do you know Barbara in Jersey City? I'm just kidding.
So I might.
You may well. Janice, what did you teach and what do you remember about Elena Kagan?
I taught English and I remember her and I remember her mother. Her mother was no-nonsense, serious woman, but so warm. You know, that's a hard combo. And she taught the little ones. And Elena, when they say force of nature, she was, you know, it's an intellectually gifted school to begin with. And she was right up there in the top.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother now has been teaching there for many, many years. You know, this is a very highly intellectual but very humanities-driven,
yes.
Heart-driven family.
And I happen to know that's Irving Kagan, her brother, who is a social studies teacher
yeah.
at Hunter
mm-hmm.
High School.
Yeah.
Barbara, you went to high school. Did you have Janice for English?
I don't know. What I think of when I think of English is Rosemary Lasker.
Of course. When did you graduate? When did you graduate, Barbara?
The same year as Elena. So I know that Rosemary was friends with Mrs. Kagan, and
yes.
you could see in her relationship with Elena and a lot of the professors. I know that the other woman mentioned, I think Allison mentioned Ira Marienhoff.
Oh, yes.
The kind of respect that the professors had and the relationship that they had with Elena could not have just been based on the fact that they knew her mom.
No.
I think that everyone recognized her incredible ability. You know, in a period of time when we were teenagers and rebelling, she already had a judicial temperament. She was circumspect.
Mature
she was
and focused.
Excuse me?
I think mature and focused. You're absolutely right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's great, and well, I think that this is this has been a long time coming.
And your reference to her mother is that she was an elementary school teacher there at Hunter at the time that Elena was a student. Barbara and Janice, thank you both so much for calling with your memories of the young Elena Kagan. Back to Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, who's covered her in her more professional years. She is 50 years old, Elena Kagan. So, Dahlia, there's a little bit of the prehistory. I've heard that the retiring Justice John Paul Stevens was himself known to be intellectually influential with Kennedy, as the president hopes that Elena Kagan would be. How much has that been the case?
I think it's been the case in certain classes of areas. I think, for instance, the key win, if you can call it that, that Stevens achieved with Kennedy was in the military commissions cases, in the Boumediene and Hamdan and the cases that had to do with presidential power in Guantanamo. I think that probably is attributable to the fact that Stevens was himself a World War II veteran. That meant a lot to Kennedy. He had huge regard for Stevens' views on that. So I think that we sometimes think that, you know, in any given case, Kennedy's an open book and Stevens and Roberts were sort of fighting for his soul. I don't think it's quite that simple. I think that there were some cases, gay rights cases are another example, where Stevens did have influence over Kennedy. But I do think we just need to remember Kennedy's not a swing justice in the sense that he sort of swings from tree to tree in every case. I think what he is very, very subject to Stevens' influence in cases, in matters in which he thinks that Stevens really, really has some personal expertise. So I think that there's a larger question about whether a 50-year-old woman who's really a generation younger than him could exert that kind of influence. Again, I think it's going to matter, this question of her temperament. She's very respectful. She's very, very able to, I think, reach out. That's going to matter to Kennedy, but I think we just need to be careful in assuming that anyone has too much sway over this one swing justice.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, if you're just joining us, President Obama has just nominated his Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, to the U.S. Supreme Court. We took some callers who knew Elena Kagan as a girl, since she is from the Upper West Side and went to Hunter College Elementary and High School. We'll take your calls on her qualifications and on her positions. She's getting criticism from some liberals for some of the positions she's taken as Solicitor General, as well as some conservatives, and we'll talk about that with Dahlia Lithwick, Senior Editor at Slate, and with you, if you want, at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I want to play a clip on maybe the most important decision in years at the U.S. Supreme Court, Citizens United, in which a divided court declared that a corporation is the legal equivalent of a human being for the sake of independent spending during election campaigns. Here is a short clip of Kagan arguing against that idea before the High Court on behalf of the president and a little bit of Chief Justice Roberts' response.
You know, an individual can be the wealthiest person in the world, but few of us, maybe some, but few of us are only our economic interests. We have beliefs, we have convictions, we have likes and dislikes. Corporations engage the political process in an entirely different way, and this is what makes them so much more damaging.
Well, that's not, I'm sorry, but that seems rather odd. A large corporation, just like an individual, has many diverse interests. The idea that corporations just are different than individuals in that respect, I just don't think holds up.
Now, Dahlia, that's an amazing clip to me, mostly because of my opinion of the case. How did Roberts go on to argue that a corporation has non-economic values like a human being?
Well, you know, I think the most interesting part of that clip, and maybe this is the subtext of your question, is that Roberts was arguing that case. I mean, one of the things that I found so interesting about Citizens United and several other cases where Roberts has been on the bench as Chief Justice and Elena has been in front of him as Solicitor General is the extent to which the roles are actually quite reversed, that Roberts is the most passionate justice, more so than I would say anyone else on the court. He sometimes, I think, almost forgets that he's not the Solicitor General. He's not the extraordinary oral advocate he used to be. And he tends to argue the case. Now, I just think it's such an interesting thing because if you continue to listen to that argument, Kagan is incredibly different. She's temperate. She's reserved. There are places where she actually admits she's made an error when she's questioned about a change in the government's position since she took on the case. She says, you know, yeah, it's true. So one of the things that I find so revealing about that isn't simply, you know, that Roberts took a very, very pro-corporate speech as free speech and you know, money equals speech. That we knew that about Roberts going into Citizens United. I think the dramatic thing is the extent to which she, as Solicitor General, has more of a judicial temperament. He, as the Chief Justice, almost has more of an advocate's temperament. And several people have noticed, and I think it's so important, Brian, that there is a little bit of friction between Roberts and Kagan at oral argument. He's quite tough on her. But I think it goes to this point that Obama was trying to make, which is it's just not her nature to be a fighter. She's not a swing-for-the-fences liberal. She's very, very calm, very mild. Roberts, interestingly, and you'll remember, going into his confirmation hearings, there was a real question about, you know, he seemed like the consummate judge's judge. But in fact, he really is a pretty sharp questioner. He is closer to an oral advocate than she is. So watching how that relationship plays out in the coming years, I think will be really fascinating.
Here is a concern about Elena Kagan from John in Paramus. John, thanks a lot for calling. You're on WNYC.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Yeah, I'm just a little concerned, a little. I find it interesting that she was never a judge. I don't know how much that has to play into it. And I was just wondering, is this a precedent, or has there been Supreme Court justices that never sat on the bench?
Dahlia?
It's a great question. You know, she was, when she was 39, so 10 years ago, Clinton put her up for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That never came to a vote. The Senate refused to take it to a vote. And so she turned around and went and taught and became the dean of Harvard Law School. So one of the questions you're going to hear a lot is, wait a minute, you were never on the bench. I think the Democrats are going to respond to that by saying, well, you wouldn't put her there. As to the other part of the question, she is the first non-judge to be put put up since Lewis Powell was put up by Nixon in 1971. So it's been decades since we saw somebody who wasn't a judge. And the only other thing I'll say, I don't know if this is going to assuage you or not, but I think that there is a sense that Obama really did want someone, quote, outside the judicial monastery, that because it's been four decades since we've had somebody who was a non-judge, it was important to him to reach out and take someone who wasn't off the bench. Now, it's not like she's this rampant outsider. She's coming off the deanship of Harvard Law School. She certainly worked in the Clinton administration. But I think there is a sense that maybe it's going to be a plus in this, all this rhetoric of she speaks for the real man, she cares about how ordinary people are impacted. I think Obama is trying to flick at the notion that she, by not being a judge, is a little bit less out of touch.
John, thank you for your call. And Dahlia, you said she's outside the judicial monastery, but I think John in Oradell is concerned that she's another one from inside a different monastery. Hi, John. You're on WNYC.
Hi. There's let me first say that I support this nomination, but I disagree with President Obama on three grounds. We will have no veterans, we will have no Protestants, and the vast majority of the Supreme Court justices will have been trained in Ivy League law schools. The Burger Court was far more representative of the United States, even though it didn't have as many Jews, as many Roman Catholics, because it was more diverse geographically and it was more diverse in terms of the legal training of the people who were members of that court. I'm upset that I'm a liberal, quite Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and I don't have a single person who I identify with on the Supreme Court.
Dahlia, how about that? Including the fact that I believe all nine of the justices, if she's confirmed, would have studied law at Harvard or Yale.
That's right. It's not even Ivy League. It's much narrower than that. It's Harvard and Yale, and she went to Princeton undergrad. So that nobody is going to say that, you know, she went to a state school, that she has, you know, massive amounts of experience outside of you know, either the executive branch, 2 years, which is a very brief time at a law firm, and then you know, the dean of Harvard. So it's true. She looks an awful lot like John Roberts. She looks an awful lot like Nino Scalia. Now, I think one answer is, yes, it's true. There's now six Catholics and three Jews on the Supreme Court. If she's confirmed. And as your caller says, that's by no means representative of this country. Overwhelmingly, we're looking at Easterners, the sort of flyover middle section of America, and I say flyover in quotes, is not represented on this court. There are huge demographic pockets that have been left out of this court. I guess the response that Obama would make is, does that matter? Does religion matter? Does it matter where you went to school? He would say, she's wildly different from the other people. She's coming out of academia. She's not a judge. She's got this intriguing record of having all these hires of conservative scholars at Harvard. So I think depending on how you slice and dice it, you can say she's a very different nominee. But of course, it depends on which demographic you choose to fight about.
And one could say that it's really conservative evangelical Protestants who are the most underrepresented, considering their prominence in the population these days. John Paul Stevens, who's retiring, is the only current Protestant on the court, but he's a liberal from one of the old mainline Protestant churches, so that evangelical rising sect of Protestant America is really not represented. And so, you know, one could make that case. Just before you go, an NPR story on Kagan today said she has an especially good rapport with Scalia and generally gets along with conservatives on the court socially. They use the word socially. Do they hang out?
I don't know that they hang out, and she's only been the Solicitor General for a year. But I think that it's probably fair to say, Brian, that she's very collegial with them. She's very colloquial in her exchanges with them. You'd never know from her six arguments at the court. She hasn't been doing this for a long time. She's really comfortable in this role. And I think the justices do kind of tweak her and play with her. So there is, I think, a level of acceptance and understanding that we saw when John Roberts came up again, and he had been a longstanding advocate at the court. So I think you're seeing some of that same, she's in the club.
And on the point of her lack of experience in this realm, I see that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has already put a statement out that says, we will carefully review her brief litigation experience as well as her judgment and her career in academia. So he's emphasizing a point on which they might go after her, lack of judicial experience, brief litigation experience. The president, I noticed, made a point to mention that the Senate had already confirmed her, the current Senate, as Solicitor General. So how can you vote against her if you just voted for her and she hasn't really changed? So I think we see some of the lines being drawn. We will see what happens. And there you have it, our coverage of President Obama's nomination of Elena Kagan to be the next U.S. Supreme Court Justice. Dahlia Lithwick, Senior Editor at Slate, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in just a minute, two views of how much the environment causes cancer. The President's Cancer Panel and the American Cancer Society disagree on this. We will have guests from both.